Okay. Patrick, Ellie, thank you so much for joining us today. I've got about four or five questions for you. The first question is why is corruption an injustice?
Corruption is an injustice because it's often regarded by those not in the know as a victimless crime, and it's far from that. Because it's always going to cost someone something. And in the world that I operate in, which is largely but not exclusively focused on corruption in the natural resource sector, what you're looking at is something that we call a resource curse, whereby some of the most resource-rich countries in the world, like Democratic Republic of Congo or Nigeria or Myanmar, for example, are also some of the poorest countries in the world, very often with oppressive governments, severe human rights abuses, instability, and sometimes and quite often conflict. And it's not a coincidence, it's precisely because they're rich in natural resources. And what happens is that, for example, foreign corporations, whether they be Western or Chinese or whatever, will get the rights from the government to exploit a particular resource, which could be an oil palm plantation or a mine or an oil block or something like that. Very often those deals will be corrupt. The local people lose their rights to that land, to self-determination. The money, most of it will not go to the exchequer of those countries, but will disappear into illicit financial flows and be laundered through to the financial centres of the world, including London or Paris or New York or wherever. And those countries that have the resources get poorer, not richer. And that's too often the case. So that's just an example to highlight why we think, you know, corruption is not just an injustice, but in fact the root cause of many human rights abuses.
And drawing on that point, you started to speak about the links between corruption, injustice and conflict dynamics. Can you give any real specific examples about how these experiences of corruption have driven those conflict dynamics?
Yeah, sure. So if you've got a country in the state of war, for example, it could be a civil war or it could be lower level conflicts within that country. And I could give you a couple of examples. So the first work that Global Witness ever did, I'm going back a long time now into the mid 1990s, there was a situation where Cambodia was coming out of civil war. There was a massive UN intervention, the biggest peacekeeping intervention ever by the UN at that time. And the country had been in civil war, and the Khmer Rouge rebel group initially decided that they would take part in the electoral process, the UN brokering. They decided then that they would back out and boycott it and return to conflict. And they occupied the forests of Cambodia in the north and the west of the country and were trading timber with Thailand. That was an illegal trade, and it was an interesting dynamic because we asked ourselves the question, is this an environmental issue or is this a human rights issue? Because they were obviously raising money to fight a war. What we found out, and this is the first investigation we did, was that the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian government were actually cooperating to export timber to Thailand because Thailand required Cambodian government certificates of origin for the product. To raise money with which they fought each other. So you have something which is corrupt, for sure, and this amazingly cynical collaboration on one side, so they could both pursue their violent means on the other. Another example I would give you would be in Charles Taylor's Liberia in around 1999-2000, after diamonds had been sanctioned and he, as I'm sure you know, was involved in civil war in that country and also funding the brutal Revolutionary United Front in Sierra Leone, notorious for hacking the limbs off thousands and thousands of people there. And he was basically gave the forests, allowed various companies to exploit the forest, to export timber worldwide, mainly to France and to China at that time. And the money flowed in. The money, you know, we estimated in 1 year, I think it was 2001 off the top of my head, that at least $100 million was unaccounted for, at least. That's mm-hmm. what we could document. Mm-hmm. And so the patrimony of the country is looted. The money goes into what we assume was Charles Taylor's war chest. The foreign companies, in this case, German, Danish, French, Chinese, etc., were involved, and they absolutely knew that this was an illegal trade, but everyone cooperated with it. So that's an example of where corruption and conflict go hand in hand.
So it strikes me as something that's pervasive, and almost systemic from top to bottom, with so many players across a global scale, even if the experiences of it are often very local. So, you know, looking forward, what are the best responses to corruption, and how are they connected to, say, other responses that people are working on to injustice?
Well, I think that one of the best responses is to end the impunity of those that are corrupt, and target legal efforts to prosecute those who are the architects of this. So, for example, another case we've been working on relates to Nigeria, where the oil companies Shell and the Italian oil company Eni, which is Italy's largest company, have been involved in the payment of an illegal payment of $1 billion to get hold of a particular oil block. And this is something that's kind of unrolling and unfolding as we speak. We've been investigating it for some years. Our assumption is that most big oil deals like this have corruption in them somewhere. And it's just a question of it, with each one, finding out how that was done. And in this case, we've got some really good information looking at this. Now, if a senior executive in an oil company gets prosecuted and jailed, that will send a chilling message to their peers in other oil companies. And I think you'll start getting them thinking again. Too often, it never even gets to court. And switching to another sector quickly, looking at the big money laundering scandals, for example, with HSBC laundering $700 million worth of Mexican drug mm-hmm. money. No one was prosecuted for that. The bank paid a fine. But no one was prosecuted for it. Until those executives get prosecuted, these things will continue. And similarly, in the case of natural resources, senior politicians and officials also need to be prosecuted.
So is it a case of, without using a catch-all, political will, or is it a case of public pressure, or a bit of both?
I think it's political will is critical. And in many of these cases, In the countries concerned, you'll find, you know, if the government of the country concerned is corrupt, then obviously it's not going to have the political will to do anything against its own officials, in which case you have to focus on those doing the corrupting, i.e. the companies. So that's something that certainly has to be done. There needs to be an international zero tolerance of this. I think public awareness and public concern would be really important, because I think most people don't really understand how pervasive and how massive this is. And if you think about the extraordinarily large amounts of money that go in foreign aid to various countries in Africa and mm-hmm. elsewhere, for example, how much of that wouldn't actually be necessary if those countries were benefiting from the resources they own? Mm-hmm. So there's a real, you know, from the point of view of being a citizen of an international aid donor, that's a really pertinent thing. Speaking personally, I'm very happy for my tax pounds to go into foreign aid, but I would be far happier if I knew they were being well spent and not actually subsidising a corrupt regime. So I think there's a lot to be done there.
And that kind of preempts my next question, which is, I suppose without naming names, or you can if you want, but what isn't working in responses to corruption and injustice?
what isn't working.
What isn't working, yeah.
Well, I think, as I just mentioned, I think actually bringing the weight of the judicial system to bear on those who are committing criminal activities evidently isn't working. In the case of the oil industry, and then this is you know, a very good and pertinent example, we and our fellow NGOs, after many, many years, more than a decade of campaigning, managed to get legislation in the US, which is Section 1504 of the Dodd-Frank Act, which required oil and mining companies listed on the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US to declare their payments to governments on a project-by-project basis, i.e. buy the oil block, buy the mine or whatever, which is a way of basically, you know, being able to look at the accounts of those companies, or, you know, the finance of those companies, say, okay, well, we know that this money went here, this money went here. And that way, you know, the citizens of the countries concerned have a chance of knowing how much money their government is making, and therefore they can hold the government to account in terms of what they're spending it on, you know, i.e. for hospitals or schools or whatever. It took a long time to get that legislation in place. Immediately, the American Petroleum Institute, which is the collective body of the oil industry, you know, with leading companies in it like Chevron, Exxon, Shell, opposed that legislation. And I won't go into bore you with the technicalities, but managed to postpone its passing for another 4 years. And it came into effect in late 2015, if my memory serves me right. In the first week of Trump's presidency, the enabling rule was disabled by the Republican Congress. So it now no longer has any effect. That is clearly, for me, industry lobbying governments, the corporate power over democratic power, to negate action on that kind of thing. I went into some detail on that because I think it's a really important point, and it's what we anti-corruption campaigners are fighting the whole time.
And, you know, just to wrap up, in terms of the direction of travel, would you say that things are getting worse with respect to corruption, or that we are seeing some shards of light?
There are some shards of light. I think basically the anti-corruption movement, you could say, began probably in 1993 when both Global Witness and Transparency International came into being. I'm not saying that, there's other people have said that. Since then, it's become, from a civil society point of view, a very big deal. You have, you know, loads of organizations now in this field, sort of open government partnership, open contracting, open data, etc., all of which is fantastic. So I think the awareness from a civil society perspective and the impact from a civil society perspective is much greater than it was. I think that from a governmental point of view, where back then in the 90s, there was very little recognition or attention paid to the kind of corruption we're talking about. Now there is, you know, it can't be ignored. And even those companies who we would say are very responsible for many corrupt deals, they would at least publicly talk about what they're doing to tackle corruption. So it's kind of more up there. There are various other laws in place. So, for example, the Dodd-Frank law I mentioned in America has now a European Union equivalent. So many of those companies are still captured by similar legislation. And it captures, you know, 200 of the world's top oil and mining companies. You know, so all of those things are really optimistic. But we need to get that message into industry itself that they have to take this very seriously. They're essentially subsidizing their operations by looting some of the poorest countries in the world. I'm not saying every company is doing that, but a significant number of significant companies are, and we need to change that culture. But we you know, the direction of travel is good, except, of course, with the advent of the Trump administration, and I'm not saying this from a partisan point of view, but they are absolutely demonstrating the corporate capture of the democratic space.
Patrick, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for asking me.